Well, we pick up here in 2 Corinthians. Paul writes this in verse 1. He says, "By the humility and gentleness of Christ, I appeal to you. I, Paul, who am timid when face to face with you, but bold toward you when away." The NIV puts these in scare quotes because it's his enemies who are saying this about him, that he likes to write really harsh letters, harsh emails, and then he shows up and he's, you know, a weakling. All right, verse 2. He says, "I beg you that when I come, I may not have to be as bold as I expect to be towards some people." These would be the false teachers. Remember, as we've been seeing throughout this letter, that there's a contingent of false teachers in Corinth. And it's putting Paul into kind of a conundrum because he's saying they're false and they're turning back and saying, no, Paul is false. And so you got the two fingers pointing both ways. Which one is the right one? Well, he says, "I am going to have to be bold toward them who think that we live by the standards of this world." Paul picks up in verse 6. He says, "We will be ready to punish every act of disobedience once your obedience is complete." Now, some people would look at this and say, well, that just shows, yeah, Paul's going to come in with a Louisville slugger and start to punish some of these people. As we read the context, we read that Paul is not talking about a physical punishment. You can't find a single example of that in the New Testament. Instead, what we see is that Paul is going to show up and debate these sophists. Sophists were these lawyers, basically these professional lecturers. They were considered the rock stars in Corinth, Greece. And to show up and to debate these guys and to basically dismantle all of their arguments, that would be punishment in their eyes. Paul says in verse 7, "You are judging by appearances. If anyone is confident that they belong to Christ, they should consider again that we belong to Christ just as much as they do." Again, the sophists were into this whole perspective of looking good, speaking well, using the right language, using the right meter in your language. I mean, everything was down to a science where you'd have to pay these guys big bucks to come and speak. And Paul's saying you're judging by appearances. He says, "So even if I boast somewhat freely about the authority that the Lord gave us for building you up rather than tearing you down, I will not be ashamed of it." So there's a little bit of sarcasm from Paul. Yeah, I wouldn't want to boast about trying to build you up rather than tear you down. Later in chapter 13, Paul's going to write that it's actually the false teachers who are doing the tearing down part, not him. He says, "I don't want to seem to be frightening in my letters to you. Some say his letters are weighty and forceful, but in person he is unimpressive and his speaking amounts to nothing." Paul must not have looked that well. I mean, when you hear about all of the tortures, the shipwrecks, the beatings, just imagine getting, you know, nearly stoned to death in Acts chapter 14. He must have had some welts. He must have looked pretty mangled. He probably looked pretty beaten up. He didn't look that good, and also his speaking amounts to nothing. How could they say that about Paul? Paul was a first-rate intellectual. It must have been that in comparison to these Greek sophists who used, you know, the high Greek, the Attic Greek when they spoke and were real polished, Greek was a second language for Paul. He was bi or trilingual. So he would debate other people successfully in a language which was not his own. Well, he says, "Such people should realize that what we are in our letters when we are absent, we will be in our actions when we are present." So he's arguing that he's going to be consistent. Then he says, "We do not dare to classify or compare ourselves with some who commend themselves." Wouldn't want to do that. "Because when they measure themselves by themselves and compare themselves with themselves, they are without understanding." So here he has thrown down the gauntlet. These guys love to compare each other with the other really slick speakers. And he's in a conundrum here. How can he actually demonstrate that he is a true teacher and that these guys are the false teachers? What do you appeal to? Do you appeal to rhetoric? Do you appeal to name-calling? Do you appeal to trying to make the other guys look really bad? Well, Paul's going to tell the facts. Principally, what he does is he appeals to reason. Sandwiched in between what we just read, we read this in verse 3. Paul writes, "For though we live in the world, we don't wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds." This was language used by Paul's contemporaries like Philo or Seneca to refer to arguments that were raised up against a contention. So if you came into a debate and you were to say, you know, I've got all these different arguments and objections, those were considered, it's the same language, strongholds. Paul says, we demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God. That was what he was wielding here. It wasn't his charisma, it wasn't his name-calling or his rhetoric. He's saying that we actually look at the claims and we dismantle the claims of the false teachers. Anything that's raised up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. And so this is our topic for this evening. Notice what it's saying here. It's not saying that we demolish people. Okay, that would be waging war as the world does. And Paul explicitly says we don't do that. It's demolishing arguments. Nor does it say that we take people captive, because that would be exceptionally creepy if he said that. He says we take thoughts captive, and that's violent language, but it's in the life of the mind. That there's certain thoughts, certain ideas that are so, you know, wicked, that can actually destroy a person's life. Depending on what you think about certain topics, that could affect the way that you live. This would also include our own thoughts. Many people quote this passage to refer to, you know, you're struggling with something and somebody says, well, you know, you really need to take your thoughts captive. You might say, well, that really doesn't fit the context. Absolutely it does. We take captive every thought. So this wouldn't just be like some kind of a contentious, argumentative thing with other people. Actually, the battle here would start with ourselves. To be a good critical thinker, it's not just being critical of what other people believe and think and assert. It's actually being critical of my own thoughts. To have clarity. To be able to think through this deeply to the point where I really see why this is the case. Well, tonight we're going to talk about learning how to think. Critical thinking. Learning how to think, not just what to think. I know a lot of people have grown up in churches where the more questions they had, the more sinful the leaders in that church thought that they were. I remember talking to one of the youth leaders, and I asked him the question. I said, so, you know, why didn't Jesus write a gospel? You got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Why not Jesus? And he said, well, we don't ask those questions here. I said, well, come on. What do you think? And he said, well, probably you could tell he was, you know, scrapping. He's like, probably because Jesus was illiterate. That's why. That got me really thinking, wait a minute, the Son of God couldn't write. Well, that's not the case here. Okay, here we want to actually explore how to critically think and deform your belief system. I'd like to set forward three different principles that are key to critical thinking. You think about when you get into these discussions with other people about the things that matter most, like your worldview, your convictions, God, eternal life, the afterlife. A lot of times these can go very sour, very quickly, and they can become argumentative. That's really not what we're talking about here. That's very seldom that that should happen. Instead, we should aim for a dialogue. You know, dia means to or between, and logos means word, having a word between, not just a word. A monologue is one log. That's where one person is just logging you to death with all their words. Dialogue is where we talk. And there's really three principles we can think of here. First is to seek understanding. Second is to recognize rhetoric when you hear it. And third is to reason carefully. Let's look at that first one there, seeking understanding. When I get into a conversation with someone who holds to different convictions or different belief in a worldview, the first thing that we should do is really ask the question, what? What do you believe? You know, thinking about concepts like this, you know, many ideas are confusing or complex. Sometimes when people share things with me on these things that are of, you know, utmost importance, they share something and I'm honestly pretty confused a lot of the time. I don't know what they're thinking. Very frequently as well, the other person is confused. It's surprising how little people have spent thinking about their worldview. The most important thing in life. What do you think about that? I just really haven't thought about it. What's your idea? Well, I just think, and you start to, you know, poke holes in that, and all of a sudden you realize they really haven't thought about this. They're confused. So we want to do our best to understand the other person. What we avoid here in these kind of conversations is talking past each other. I'm sure you're all sick of the political pundits when they're constantly yelling at each other, and it's just like whoever yells the loudest wins. Well, I don't really debate politics that much, but I do talk, you know, to friends and loved ones, and, you know, you start talking about things, and don't you hate when you get 30 minutes into an argument and you realize I was talking about A and she was talking about B, or worse yet, I was talking about A and she was talking about Z, and you just feel like, oh, I didn't listen. I was not listening. You know, this comes straight out of the Bible, Proverbs 18. It says, it is to a man shame to speak before he listens and seeks understanding, not talking past each other. A good sign here would be if you could represent the other person's view as good or perhaps even better than them. I remember I was working on a research project years ago on the subject of predictions in the Old Testament that were made hundreds of years in advance for Jesus. And so I was getting my hands on everything I could, you know, books and MP3s and videos, and just trying to study this to death. And one of the debates I listened to was between a Christian theologian and a Jewish theologian. And the moderator of the debate said, you know, well, let's kick this off. You know, so to the Jewish theologian, what do you think about this particular messianic prophecy? And the Christian theologian spoke up. I was like, oh, man, this is going to be really rude. And he said, you know, this guy is my buddy, and we've debated before. He said, do you think I could take the floor and give his point of view? So he said, all right, this is really weird, but sure, go ahead. So the Christian said, well, here's all the reasons why an interpreter of his persuasion wouldn't hold to this view. And he gave, like, you know, 8 reasons, very in-depth, very sharp. And as he's listing these reasons, I'm thinking to myself, dude, you're shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, you're going to lose the debate. Afterward, the host turned to the other theologian, and he said, actually, I could have gotten a cup of coffee. He just gave me the whole case right there on my side. That'd be a good sign if you could actually know what other people believe to such a depth and a level that they feel like they're understood. Questions like this I find to be really helpful. You know, somebody shares something, and you say, okay, what did you mean by blank? Okay, you don't put any stank on this, by the way. You don't say, what did you mean by blank? No, you just say, you know, hey, what did you mean by that? You know, use that word. Or how would you define that term? People will be like, what do you mean? I'm not being mean or anything. I'm just saying, you know, I've heard different people use that term differently. How are you using that? Really seeking to understand. Or can you help me understand what you meant by such and such? Or could you explain more what you mean when you say such and such? You wouldn't believe that when we get into these discussions over things which are important, and so there's a lot of capital invested, if we can just take the time to really love another person by trying to understand them and see where they're coming from, how gracious the conversation can really go. Secondly, we want to agree before we disagree. We want to agree with something. There has to be something. I remember trying to practice this principle, and I was talking to a girl, and she said, I worship Satan. And I was thinking to myself, how do I agree with anything? I was like, well, I believe in Satan. There's something I agree with there. This idea of agreeing before you disagree, this isn't just some kind of a pleasantry that we have today. This is actually biblical. Paul, it says in Acts 17:16, it says, Paul's spirit was being provoked within him as he was observing the city full of idols. And if you've studied first century idolatry and the occult practice of what these religious practices were, it was savage. I mean, sex cults, where you'd have to go visit the women priestesses, and it was basically, you know, thousands of prostitutes to worship the certain god. Archaeology has uncovered the god Kronos, who had his hands outstretched, and the worshippers of this particular cultus would take their newborn babies and fry them on his open hands. It's no wonder that Paul says that his spirit was being provoked. The word there is paroxeno. It's like a paroxysm. If you're in the medical industry, what's that? A paroxysm is like a convulsion, something like that. Paul's looking at this city full of idols. My God, this is ruining people's lives. There is no Kronos. He's not real. None of this is real. And he's angered. He's provoked. And yet, when he goes to speak to these people, what does he open up? What are the first words out of his mouth? He says, men of Athens, I observe that you are very religious in all respects. He doesn't say that he agrees with them. He just says that, well, I can agree on the fact that you worship something. You're religious. And this is a pretty good practice as well, to really think through how we can connect with another person before we start to disagree. We might not always agree, but find common ground, I guess. A third principle here in way of understanding, again, so far you're not giving your view. You're just trying to understand what another person believes, is to ask why. Questions like this. How did you come to that conclusion? How do you know that? What led you to find that persuasive? Or is that a probable explanation, or is it a possible explanation? See, many times people think that they can get away with just like a bedtime story for a worldview. What do I mean? Well, for example, somebody just says something like this. You know, I just believe that the universe popped into being and it caused itself. And then aliens came from another planet and they, you know, panspermia littered basically the plot of the movie Prometheus. You know, basically spread out DNA and then we arose from that. And it's like, whoa, that's a really cool story. How did you come to that conclusion? How do you know that? What led you to find that is that probable or is it possible? I suppose it's possible. Most things are possible, but is that probable? A lot of times people think that they can just give a good bedtime story about a worldview. Okay, if we're going to make an assertion, we have to back it up with an argument or evidence. I can make assertions all day. That doesn't mean anything, but you have to actually demonstrate why the assertion is true. Secondly, to recognize rhetoric. Rhetoric can be good. Rhetoric is basically putting emotion or humor on top of a really good argument. You know, some of the best speakers and thinkers throughout history were great rhetoricians. But rhetoric should never be a replacement for reason. Let me show you what I mean here. Okay, I'm just going to do a number of memes here. Meme philosophy. Here's, you know, the Greek pantheon. And the meme goes like this. We're really both atheists. We are? I didn't think I was. Well, you don't believe in 3,000 gods. I don't believe in 3,001 gods. So I just go one god further. It's good rhetoric. But then I start to think about that. Wait a minute. So if I talk to a guy and he said, yeah, we're both single. How do you figure? Well, you just have one more wife than I do. See, that wouldn't work. You know, we're both polygamists. We are? Yeah, you just have, you know, multiple less wives than I do. Nobody on earth has cancer. Just some people have one more tumor than others. Okay, the difference between those two things is tremendous. To say believing God does exist and God doesn't exist. That is a worldview shaking. And to make it sound like, it's really not that big of a deal. It's just 3,001. That's rhetoric. That's not really even an argument. How about this one? Science flies you to the moon. Religion flies you into skyscrapers. I've seen this all over the internet. That's rhetoric. That's what that is. What's it doing? It's trying to make a comparison. Science does this, religion does that. And flies. It's basically showing what one does and what the other doesn't. Well, first of all, okay, the small sect of people who believed in that specific sect of Islam don't represent everybody. Okay, so that would be one small sect of a religion. And to say that all religions are basically equivalent to that, that's not true. Come on, let's think about this for a second. That their religion is identical to an Amish person? You know, is an Amish person ever going to bomb anybody? No, that's never going to happen. Moreover, it makes it sound like, you know, all the scientists who got us to the moon were atheists. What? What world are we living in? The astronauts who went to the moon were Christians. How about that? In fact, I brought this clip here. This is from Time magazine where they did a whole feature on this. Check this out.
We had never seen the likes of images like that, certainly not coming back live.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep.
They read aloud from Genesis, all three astronauts taking turns on Christmas Eve.
I must say, as I started it, it came to me really for the first time that this was a momentous thing.
And God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day.
So how about that? Imagine that. Now, this wasn't the Apollo 11 mission that actually landed on the moon, so it's not quite right. But okay, but these guys made it up, Apollo 8. And imagine watching TV and they're just reading through the book of Genesis on live TV. They were Christians. That doesn't fit. How about this one? When the Haiti disaster occurred, people said, Bibles for Haiti. Thank you. This looks delicious. See how it's rhetoric? It's not really basically making any kind of an argument. What's it trying to paint? That Christians are just trying to give their faith. They're not really trying to help anyone's needs. Well, that's not true. Come on, let's think about that. Now, if somebody read that, it would have rhetorical force, where somebody would say, oh, that's really clever. Oh, yeah, those Christians again. Well, when we look at this, it's not. Arthur C. Brooks, he wrote this book, Who Really Cares? Not a question mark. It's like, who are the people who actually care? He is a social scientist, PhD, and went through, he had 10 different data sets that he went through, and he factored out ethnicity, age, okay, got rid of those variables. This is what he found. He said religious households who make $49,000 a year gave 3.5 times more money than non-religious households. He says they volunteered twice as often, 57% more likely they were to help a homeless person, and they were two-thirds more likely to give blood. I mean, this book just goes through in details. He has a whole appendix on his study and how he formulated it. No, that's not the case. Now, when we read that, I'm not trying to make the point that if, you know, you don't believe in God, then all of a sudden you're this evil, selfish person. Okay, that's not my point. My point is that this rhetorical meme, which people read and click and say, huh, that's really funny. Some of these things they've not thought deeply about. They've not really looked into it. And so consequently, this is actually changing people's worldviews. Thirdly, we need to learn how to reason carefully, being a critical thinker. Familiarizing ourselves with some of the basic canons of logic and reason, fallacies and informal fallacies. Let's do a couple of these here. Self-defeating statements, for example, like this one. Nothing is written in stone. On a piece of, that's hilarious, isn't it? Nothing is, okay, obviously we see why that would be a self-defeating statement, right? Another example, no English sentence is 8 words long. No English sentence is 8 words long. Yeah, maybe that's 7. It's 7 words long, whatever. You get the idea. No English sentence is longer than 3 words. How about that? This one here from Futurama. No one drove in New York. There was too much traffic. And that's how everyone laughs at Futurama when you watch. I'm like, bah! That's one of the funniest cartoons I've ever seen. I'm like one of 3 people that ever watched that show. Self-defeating. How could no one drive? Okay, get the point. Here's a Facebook post I read recently. This is what the person said. She said, lesson I learned recently, don't believe anything anyone says. Nobody knows the meaning of the word honesty. And I thought about typing, that's a self-defeating statement, you know? I didn't. I was thinking to myself, wait a minute, don't believe anything anyone says, so you're part of anyone, you're one of any people, and nobody that would include you, so why should I listen to you? Self-defeating statements are statements which are made that also reference themselves, but then they also destroy themselves. Some people call these suicidal arguments, because you make the argument and then it kills your argument. Oh, here's one. You guys ready for this one? All right, here we go.
If you're not with me, then you're my enemy.
Only a Sith deals in absolutes.
Reason number 367 why that movie stunk. Only a Sith. That was an absolute statement, Ben Kenobi. That means you're a Sith. All right, anyways. Okay, let's think about some self-defeating statements. You get the idea. Nobody can know objective truth. Okay, that's a statement. Nobody can know objective truth. Nobody can know it. That would include the speaker himself or herself. Do you know that statement objectively? Do you believe that that statement you said was true? Well, no, because I don't believe in objective truth. So what you said wasn't true. No. So then why should I listen to your statement? Well, it's subjectively true. Well, then it's subjectively true for you, but that doesn't impugn on me in any way. Why should I listen to you? We cannot know what a person is trying to communicate through their words. This is really a postmodern thought. I know this is really reductionistic. A postmodern person would bristle at this. But in postmodern thinking, basically everyone has their baggage of ethnicity or age or gender or culture. And so when one person comes to a text and another person comes to a text, they bring all that baggage with them. And so it's really impossible to understand the authorial intent, the intent of the author, because we all have our lenses through which we read and understand words. Okay, this actually was brought up in a movie, which I thought was pretty good. It's called Invasion. Nicole Kidman kind of expresses this postmodern view. In fact, the whole movie is about this subject. Check this out.
Well, as a psychiatrist, you must know this to be true.
To be honest, Ambassador, when someone starts talking to me about the truth, what I hear is what they're telling me about themselves more than what they're saying about the world.
Quite right. Well done, Doctor.
But you're right.
Wait a minute. Let's think about it. Well done, Doctor. Great stuff. Wait a minute. Is what you're saying true? Then what you're telling us is really something more about yourself, Nicole Kidman, not about the statement that you're trying to make. Yeah, that can't be right. Also, you think about it like this. Everyone says, well, it's really impossible to, you know, have an interpretation. Maybe you heard somebody say, well, that's just your interpretation. Okay, that is my interpretation. What's wrong with it? Okay, you can have your interpretation, but we have to decide which one makes the most sense. Think about it like this. You know, you go across and you see a sign like this. And one person's like, I think that means, you know, people are crossing through here. And somebody else says, well, no, I think that's showing that everyone here owns a briefcase. This sign here, drug-free zone. There's free drugs here? I didn't know that. I'm going to bring a suitcase next time. Wow. Free drug zone. Welcome to America. Slow children through here. Like little children are going, no, they run just as fast as everyone else. These are really not that hard to understand. I know a lot of people say the same thing about the Bible. They're like, well, you can't really, that's just your interpretation. Who are you to say? The person whose it is to say is the person who has the best reasons for their interpretation. That's who. And really, this is greatly exaggerated. I mean, think about this passage here from Isaiah 45:5. I am the Lord. There is no other. Besides me, there is no God. How many different interpretations do we really get from a statement like that? I mean, how many gods are there? I am the Lord. There is no other God. There's one God. That's what that's claiming to say. How about this? You get a prescription from your doctor. How many people would take this view when they're reading the instructions on the medicine bottle? You know, the medicine bottle says you're supposed to take 2 daily, but I interpret that to mean that I'm supposed to take 7 every minute. That's my interpretation. Now, language is really not that difficult, is it? In fact, we can communicate. In fact, it cracks me up how postmodern authors are always trying to argue about how we can't understand people from their words, and they write big books on it, 300 pages long. Makes you wonder, you know, like, what if I came up to him and said, man, I love how your book supports that we can know truth from the written word. No, that's not the intent of my book at all. Oh, that's my interpretation of it. No, that's not what I was intending. Oh, so I was supposed to actually interpret what you said accurately according to the author. That's self-defeating. What about this statement? All morality is relative to private opinion. It'd be like a worldview called moral relativism. So you shouldn't judge other moral views. That's self-defeating. Think about that. The term here, you shouldn't judge. What is that? That's a moral precept. That's a moral command. It could have said, you shalt not judge. That's what it could have said. All morality is relative. Then why should I or should I not judge other moral views? What about this one? I will only believe in what I can see, smell, taste, touch, or hear. I've heard people say this, you know, I don't believe in God. Why not? Well, because I can't perceive him through the 5 senses. That's why. Okay, one of the problems with that is if you could perceive God through the 5 senses, he would no longer be God. Because God is an immaterial being. He's an infinite soul. Okay, so if you could grab onto God, that wouldn't be God at that point. Moreover, this is self-defeating. Why? Because you can't see, smell, taste, touch, or hear this proposition. You might say, well, yeah, I can. It's right up there on the screen. No, you can't. It's a proposition. It's a statement. It's making an assertion. You can't touch assertions. You can't touch propositions. Like when somebody says, you know, your words really touched me the other night, you're not going to look for fingerprints, right? The concept, conceptually, you were touched. So if we can't see, smell, taste, touch, or hear this proposition, then that would mean that this proposition is false. That's what that would mean. A similar statement is something like this. This is a worldview called scientism. Not science, but scientism. It's evil twin. Scientism would say something like this. You know, philosophical questions are meaningless, and only scientific claims are true and rational. Again, self-defeating. This isn't a statement of science. It's a statement about science. Can you use the scientific method to discover the truth of this statement? No, this is a philosophical statement about science, not a statement of science itself. Another fallacy, which is really popular, is the straw man fallacy. This is where you're in a discussion and somebody basically paints a view that is just so atrocious. Nobody's ever held that view, and it's really not the view you're trying to hold. You know what I'm saying? They call it a straw man because instead of attacking the person, they attack, you know, some kind of a scarecrow. And then they defeat the Scarecrow, and then they say, oh yeah, I defeated you. No, you didn't. Okay, here's one. Here's Dan Barker asking, if there is no God, what is the purpose of life? Is like asking, if there is no master, whose slave shall I be? That's some good meme philosophy right there. But let's think about that for a second. Would we hold that God is comparable to a slave master? Is that what we're saying? That God wants to come into your life and control you? He wants to whip you and beat you and make your life miserable? That's a straw man comparison. Nobody believes that. What about this one? Another meme. According to religion, I am broken, flawed, sinful, dumb, weak, nothing. According to science, I am full of wonder, smart, a great learner, beautiful, potential for greatness. Which do you think is more damaging? Okay, wait a minute. So, how many Christians do you know who actually hold to that list on the left? Okay. And moreover, the ones on the right, we would agree with those completely. Okay, so why do they get to lay claim to that? There's also a problem here. Beautiful? Okay, she is beautiful. She's a cute kid. How did you get that through the scientific method? Did you get a bunch of beakers and, you know, Bunsen burners and then come out? She's beautiful. She's definitely beautiful. Here's David Cross, the atheistic comedian. He said, back when the Bible was written, then edited, then rewritten, then rewritten, then re-edited, then translated from dead languages, then retranslated, then edited, then rewritten, then given to kings for them to take their favorite parts, then rewritten, then re-rewritten, then translated again, then given to the Pope for him to approve, then rewritten, then edited again, then re-re-re-re-rewritten again, all based on stories that were told orally 30 to 90 years after they happened to people who didn't know how to write. So, dot, dot, dot. You know, there's not, I don't want to overstate this, almost everything in that statement is patently false. Patently false. The Bible was not translated from Greek into another language, and from that language into another language, and that language into English. Textual critics, there's a whole field of study on this, okay? If you just look into it, they go back to the earliest Greek manuscripts. And that's where it's, you know how many times it's translated? Once. That's how many times. You go back from the beginning and you get those and you make translations based on that. And kings, they get to choose their favorite parts. I mean, that's a straw man argument. I wonder if he's ever studied this field. I think not. The genetic fallacy. This is where you are trying to show that somebody is false by actually showing the origin of their belief. If you can show where their belief came from, it means that it's false. I'll give you an example. Somebody says something like this. The only reason that you're a Christian and not a Buddhist is because you were raised in a Christian home. Huh. Interesting. Now, I know you could argue about this. You know, my wife was raised in a Buddhist home, and she's a Christian. So we could point that out. We could do a survey. You know, how many people here hold the same worldview as your parents? Okay, we could do all that. We don't have to. This commits the genetic fallacy. Who cares how you learned it? The only reason that you believe in Abraham Lincoln was because you learned it in third grade in history class. Checkmate. Yeah, that is where I learned it. It's also true. As I've continued to study and evolve in my thinking, I'm really convinced he was the 16th president of the United States. But the origin of a belief doesn't invalidate the belief itself. Another one, the only reason you're a Christian is because you hit a hard time in your life and you needed something to cling to. That would be my story. That would be checkmate right there, you know. You were living a life that was, you just felt like was, rough. You really couldn't make it. Things were going really poorly. You were depressed, miserable, feeling like life was meaningless. And then you came to Christ. You know, that is true. But just because that's the means through which I developed a belief, that doesn't mean that the belief is false. How do we know I wasn't clinging to something that was real? See, this might be how I learned it, but it doesn't say whether or not the belief is true or false. We think about this as well, the false dilemma fallacy. This is where you only give two options when there's more than two. Here's one from Dr. Lawrence Krauss, a real famous atheist today. He says, you're choking, and I have two choices. One, I perform the Heimlich maneuver, or two, I pray for you. Which is it, Christian? I don't know, maybe call an ambulance. That would be another option. Do the Heimlich and then pray. Pray while you're doing the Heimlich. Why does it have, even as his fingers pointed, it's either or, it's one or the other. Why can't it be both? I've just never understood that. Sam Harris, he says, either God can do nothing to stop catastrophes like this, or he doesn't care to, or he doesn't exist. God is either impotent, meaning not all powerful, evil, or imaginary. Take your pick. and choose wisely. Well, this is such a deep discussion, the problem of evil. I would really hate to even try and start to respond to it, even though I have a lot to say. Let me just say this. There's more than those three options. Like, what if God has some kind of morally sufficient purposes for which he's waiting to interfere with the human race? What if that's the case? Yeah, why does it have to be one of the three? This actually wouldn't be a false dilemma. It'd be a false trilemma, because there's three. You think that's really funny? All right. Then there's the ad hominem fallacy. This is Latin for against the man, attacking the human, the person. Here's Bill Nye. He says, the best argument against religion is a 5-minute conversation with the average religious person. Okay, that's ad hominem. That's basically saying religious people are stupid, therefore Jesus didn't rise from the dead. Okay, that doesn't follow. And moreover, when you look at this, I mean, when I read that, I was like, huh, zing, you know. That's the best argument against religion? That's the best you've got? And it only took 5 minutes. Wow, you've really looked into this, Bill Nye. The science guy. All right, Sam Harris. He says, my concern with religion is that it allows us to, by the millions, to believe only what lunatics or idiots could believe on their own. See, that has force to it, but what is it really saying? It's not saying anything about the truth or falsity of God. It's basically just name-calling. Is that what we really want our discourse to be like? If we just get rid of, we just totally get rid of reason. You know what happens if we do that? Then it becomes what's called voluntarism. Whoever has the strongest will wins. That was the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche. Whoever has the bigger voice, whoever name calls the most. Richard Dawkins was famous for saying, we should just ridicule faith. That's what it's come to. In a civilized society where we can't just actually have a dialogue and discussion about this, we have to name call like that. Well, those would be some ways to think through how to carry on a conversation. And really, even for your own thinking. To take every thought captive. To think through, does that really make sense? I know it has rhetorical force. I know it's coming from an expert. But what do I think about that? To seek understanding, to recognize rhetoric, and to reason carefully. Well, as we conclude tonight, you might be saying, you know, why are we even studying this? We just went through all these different logical fallacies. I thought I was coming to a Bible study. Why are we doing this? Well, here's why. Because truth really matters. One person put it this way. He said, ideas have consequences and false ideas have victims. What you believe with regard to your worldview, what you believe about these big questions of life, will necessarily have an impact on the way that you live. Yes, it will. Truth could be out there, but your beliefs aren't lining up with reality. And reality has a problem. It causes consequences in your life. If you're living in a world where God exists and you're trying to deny that and you're trying to flee from that, you're going to constantly be bumping into reality. And so our ideas matter. Maybe you're here tonight and you're like, well, I just haven't really thought about these things. Think about this for a second. We're talking about the biggest questions of life. And you're not going to give any more time than surfing through the web and clicking on memes. That's as far as it goes for you. Come on, have some integrity here to actually spend some time to see if this is true. Like if eternal life was real, that would make a difference. I'm not saying to you that you have to believe that just because I said it. That wasn't our topic for tonight. But if it was real, that would have an impact on your life. Like imagine if somebody came into a hospital and there was a sick girl. She's dying of cancer. And a doctor comes in and says, hey, I've got these pills here that could actually help her survive and actually give another 60 years to her life. Yeah, if you're anything like me, you might be like, this guy's probably a quack. He could be a lunatic. He could have, you know, put on a doctor's outfit and snuck in here and has some Tic Tacs in that bottle. You know, how much does it cost and who is it experimented on? Okay, those are all valid questions. But to say that that claim for the little girl doesn't matter, that it doesn't matter if you could extend her life another 60 years, of course it matters. If that's true, how much more should it matter if you could extend your life forever? If eternal life actually exists, it's incumbent on us to search out and see if this is actually true. And so I'd leave you with the question, are you open-minded enough to explore Jesus and his message of love and forgiveness? If you're here tonight and you've never looked into this, this is something that could completely change your life for the better. I could sit here all night talking about the ways that Jesus Christ has changed my life. But that's open for you. That's a journey that you're going to have to pursue. Let me tell you one thing, though. If you ever decide that you're ready to come to Christ, just know he's willing to accept you free of charge. He paid for everything on the cross. You pay for nothing. You just have to trust in him. And it could change your whole life and the next life.